is Truth Be Told, a Sheridan Life radio podcast exploring the complex issues affecting Indigenous communities in Canada. I'm your host, Danielle Orr. So, I get this question a lot. Why you? Why do you care so much about these issues? I'm currently a journalism new media student at Sheridan College. My background is in criminology and sociology, and during that degree, I learned a lot about Canada's relationship with Indigenous peoples, historically and today. I remember saying to myself back then that one day I have to be a part of the solution. I just didn't know how at the time. As journalists, we have a platform to give voice to matters of importance to Canadians. Unfortunately, the issues we'll be discussing on the podcast have been traditionally unreported, although we are seeing slow changes to this. Full disclosure, I am a white woman. I do not have any personal claim to the stories or information you'll be hearing on this podcast, and I have to acknowledge that privilege. But it is extremely important to me to spread awareness with the platform that I have and provide a conduit through which audiences can hear voices with lived experience, knowledge, and expertise. I hope you'll join me on this journey to greater understanding. In this episode, you'll hear from Elijah Williams about his role at the Indigenous Learning and Support Center at Sheridan College, and about the center itself. Many post-secondary institutions in Canada have a support center now, and for the ones that don't, I would urge you to inquire why this is the case. Those centers may take on the same role as the one we have at Sheridan, but for the purposes of this episode, we'll focus on this one. I hope you'll listen until the end of this episode because we talk about the significance of labels, and what you hear about them may not be what you'd expect. We'll also discuss Elijah's experience growing up in the Six Nations of the Grand River Reserve in Caledonia, which will lead us into introducing some key issues faced by Indigenous communities today. Mel Bronwyn, our assistant producer, will also be joining me to interview Elijah. So, let's dive in to our interview. So we have Elijah Williams here. He's the Director of Indigenous Engagement at the Indigenous Learning and Support Center on campus at Sheridan. To start, do you mind doing proper land acknowledgement?
Sure, and thank you for having me here. I'm very glad to be here. So we hear land acknowledgements now, especially in institutions before formal events or even just a small gathering of people. But the land acknowledgement is a way for us to acknowledge sort of our connection to the land, like our ancestors, so our connection to the people that were here before us who were stewards of the land. So for me, when I do a land acknowledgement, I like to explain why it's important that we do it. Because I know that some people read from the script, but it's important that we understand where we have come from. And a part of that is acknowledging those nations that were historically here. So the nations that Sheridan resides on specifically is the Anishinaabe Nation, Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat people. And the reason why we mention even Mississaugas of the Credit on its own is because they hold a treaty with the Crown for this territory. So they hold certain treaties that they signed. So it's important that we acknowledge the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation specifically, outside of the other nations that were mentioned.
When did this become a common practice at Sheridan specifically? Do you know?
I believe it started around 2015-16. Okay. So our office opened in late 2014-15. Mm-hmm. So it sort of started after the center was established, and the previous manager of the center advocated for it to be done. And it was kind of like happening around all these other institutions. Government was starting to do it around that time. So it was kind of like a trendy moment at the time. Right. But since then, I think it's more of an educational opportunity. The way that I look at it is that it's a reminder of who was here before us so that we could have a place that we can work and thrive on now. So for me, I think any education opportunity, I'm all for it. And so that's kind of how it started.
Okay, so before we continue on, I would like you to describe your role at the Indigenous Learning and Support Center and what it's like to work for the center.
So in my role as director, so I oversee our Center for Indigenous Learning and Support. Mm-hmm. And in our mandate, we support all Indigenous students that come to Sheridan. Mm-hmm. So we support with financial aid, we support with transition into school. But in my role, in my day-to-day role, is to provide advice and guidance to our senior leadership team. So I report to the Vice President of Inclusive Communities. Her name is Dr. Jane Nagobia. Okay. So we're part of the larger Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Initiative. However, what I would say to whoever's listening is that Indigenous people are not equity-seeking groups. Mm-hmm. Even though that we are in this path, our knowledge and circumstances runs linear on the same kind of spectrum of the equity and diversity work.
Yeah.
And there's many reasons for that. Indigenous people have treaty relationships with the government. There's the crown relationship. There's a special kind of relationship when it comes to Indigenous people of Canada. Mm-hmm. So I also sit on a lot of committees, and I try to give an authentic perspective to what is currently happening. And so my worldview starts on Six Nations of the Grand River, so I try to instill that into what we do at Sheridan. Because for me, Indigenous knowledge is empowering, and I think mm-hmm. it could be empowering for everybody.
Do you know how many students there are at Sheridan this year who identify as being Indigenous?
So there's roughly between 200 and 300 that we know of. So okay. Students coming from all over Canada. So mm-hmm. we have people that come out from BC, Alberta. We have students coming from Nunavut, out wow. east, and even just locally as well. So we have a quite diverse group of Indigenous students.
Mm-hmm. And how many visit the center on a regular basis?
It varies. So we only have one office currently at our Trafalgar campus, but we're here to support all students at all three campuses. So it is difficult since the buses are limited now from Davis to Trafalgar, and mm-hmm. there's no direct mm-hmm. access from HMC to here. So it is harder for students, but there could be 20 students at a given day throughout the day, right? It depends on the week, mm-hmm. if there's exams or anything like that. So it changes often, okay. but we do see a lot of students.
Okay. And what kind of programs and initiatives are there for students who may not know that much about the center?
Mm-hmm. We offer different programming events. So what we've done this year specifically is weekly lunch and learn. So there's an opportunity to have like traditional food, but also to learn about something. So it could be a bead making workshop, or it could be learn about corn husk. Mm-hmm. So kind of those traditional methods. We also offer elder access support. So students to access an elder. And the elder we work with is Bertha Skye. So she's been kind of the anchor of our center since it's opened. And we try to provide as much culturally specific program as possible. Now, we can't get every student's background, but what we try to do is be as inclusive as possible to the diversity, right? Because when you look at how massive Canada is, there's so many different cultures and customs that each person who they're whatever nation they're coming from, we might not necessarily be able to provide that specific to them, but what we can do mm-hmm. is connect them with community supports if mm-hmm. needed.
Can non-Indigenous students participate in certain workshops, like the beadwork, for example?
So it's open to everybody. So everything that we do is pretty much open to everybody. Now, the only time it wouldn't be if it is an isolated kind of specific ceremony for a specific student. But generally speaking, all of our events are open to every student at Sheridan because it's an opportunity for non-Indigenous students to also learn
right.
about what Indigenous people do and kind of the customs and practices. And mm-hmm. we're here to provide support to everybody.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I find that a lot of students aren't aware of the Indigenous Learning and Support Center and that it is open to non-Indigenous students. So that's amazing to know and for the listeners to know as well.
It is. And because we participate in orientation, the kind of welcome to all new students. But what I would say is, like, anyone that goes to orientation will forget everything that they're told right on that yeah. same day. Mm-hmm. So we do mention that we are open, but I think mm-hmm. we can do more of a better job at kind of reinforcing that throughout the year. Like, you mm-hmm. can come by. Uh-huh. Now our center can't fit a lot of people in, but I think right. what we can do is offer those supports when needed, right, to anybody.
Okay. And you've mentioned something interesting. You mentioned the importance of accessing an elder. Could you explain to me a little bit more of the importance of that role?
So elders, it varies by community, but usually elders play a very important role in kind of instilling our traditional culture and language. Mm-hmm. So they kind of, the community, usually an elder doesn't call themselves an elder. It's usually the community that kind of bestows that upon them because they hold a vast amount of knowledge. They understand the language, or they really understand a part of the culture that they hold. So they're really high regard knowledge keeper, mm-hmm. and why it's important for students to have access is to have access to that kind of culture, right? Even mm-hmm. if it might not be from their own, maybe they might find similarities in that elder that's from this territory. Mm-hmm. 'Cause when I was just in the Yukon back in August, but when I was listening to the elder speak out in Yukon, it just reminded me of back home right away of like mm-hmm. how our elders would kind of give knowledge. So I think they're just an important role model.
Right. That's amazing.
So what concerns have Indigenous students voiced to you during your time working at the Learning and Support Center?
So it varies, but the consistent message that I hear is that Indigenous students want a bigger space, and not necessarily more office space, but a space that's reflective of their identity. Mm-hmm. So since Sheridan only has one office, we're not doing it for all three. So the one that I heard more recently is Indigenous students want a space at our Brampton campus. Mm-hmm. But now space is a really hot topic because mm-hmm. I think we all know that everyone wants more space in some capacity. But I think how do we represent somebody's identity better in our campus environment? There shouldn't be any blank walls that don't really have anything on it. I think we can do a better job at representing. Now, my response is usually there's time, there's money to that, right? But what can we do in the immediate to kind of support that? So we are looking at developing a shared space in the new year in Brampton. So mm-hmm. hopefully that will come to fruition as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. But I am optimistic that where we are at Sheridan, we are in the early stages of Indigenous education and Indigenous support, mm-hmm. but we are doing a really good job at this college in terms of responding to those changes. And when students bring up a change, we respond quite quickly. Mm-hmm. It might not seem quickly to the student's perspective, but when you look at how institutions operate, it's usually slow. Some places are slower than others, but I think what we do here is we respond accordingly.
I think it's really interesting what you said. You know, there are other ways of creating space for an idea or for awareness. It's mental space too. It's not just physical space, right? So mm-hmm. I love that you said that. So the center's name used to be Aboriginal Initiatives yes. Center. Why was the name changed to Indigenous Learning and Support Center?
So at the time when it was called Aboriginal Initiatives, it just felt too vague of, if you said that to somebody, nobody could really give you a straight answer of what that would mean. Because what are Aboriginal initiatives at the end of the day kind of thing? So when we changed the name, we thought, okay, we're seeing this office kind of evolve into a place of learning, mm-hmm. but we're also still supporting students at the time. So how can we combine those two? So that's kind of how the name came to be. Because we are a center that provides support to students, Indigenous students, but also we support the learning of non-Indigenous students, faculty, staff. So our role at that time, it was evolving into what we're doing right now, which is providing support to students, but also we're providing the learning opportunities that are there.
Mm-hmm. So we would all agree then that definitions are extremely important in terms of explaining what it is that you do. And now, could you explain to listeners who may not know what the difference is between Indigenous, Aboriginal, and First Nations?
So this is where it gets complicated. Terminology gets very complicated, and we live in a world of terminology right now, mm-hmm. definitions. So what I will say to the listeners is Indigenous people didn't come up with these terms, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't decide to call one day if we're going to be called Aboriginal or Indigenous. Mm-hmm. So these are government terms that were used to describe our people. Mm-hmm. So the term Aboriginal is defined by our Constitution in Section 35. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a very legal definition, but it basically breaks down three distinct groups in Canada: First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. So under First Nations, that's probably the most diverse in terms of nations. So really, it's just describing the original people of Canada. Mm-hmm. What I would say is that I would encourage people to learn who are those specific nations, because at the end of the day, prior to European contact, there were distinct nations. They weren't all the same. Mm-hmm. But what happened was when colonization came in and they try to paint everyone as the same kind of picture and same brush. And so that's where those terms come in. It was really in the beginning the term Indian was used to describe us, which I would say is offensive in some cases. It's still used to this day in terms of legal context. We have right. the Indian Act. Right. But again, it's a term that was created for us, not by us. Mm-hmm. So what I would say is try to get more specific as possible. And the term Indigenous became more popular, I would say, when the last 5 to 10 years, right. As people were moving away from the term Aboriginal, mm-hmm. and people got it confused with, so they used the term Aborigines in Australia, so people were getting that confused.
Okay.
And then there's also debate around the kind of etymology of the term Aboriginal, so they broke it into like ab, which would be like abnormal kind of thing, and then original, so not original.
Uh-huh. So would you say Indigenous, that the term there is more encompassing, or
people argue that's more inclusive?
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that it is more inclusive?
I like it, the sound of it, better.
Yeah.
But what, like I said, I would encourage people to learn their specific nations. Like for okay. me, I come from the Cayuga Nation, which is a part of a larger group, which is what we do call ourselves is the Haudenosaunee, mm-hmm. which means people of the longhouse,
yeah.
or this big great house. And under that is there 6 other nations. So we're, the way our people formed was like a league of nations. So we have the Onondaga, we have the Seneca, we have the Mohawk, we have the Tuscarora and Oneida. That's all under this kind of one longhouse, as we would call it.
So in your view, getting down to specifics is more appropriate.
Yes.
Indigenous, as you said, we're using that now, but it's also government imposed. Even though when you think of a term it's as being inclusive, it can actually be better to acknowledge the specifics.
Yes, so. Yes, it's more specific as possible. But if you are just speaking generally of all of Canada, yeah. then it is okay to use Indigenous. But mm-hmm. if you're speaking specifically of one community, then use their community.
Yeah,
because
there's
names.
Not just one identity. There's yeah. very yeah. many.
Yes, mm-hmm. very many.
Mm-hmm.
It says in your bio that you're part of the Turtle Clan.
Yes.
So what does it mean to be a member of the Turtle Clan?
So how, prior to European contact and the way that our family structures were structured, we followed our mother's lineage.
Mm-hmm.
So our nation and our clan was passed down. So the way families were grouped together was by clan family. Because we didn't have first names and last names, we only had one name.
Mm-hmm.
And so our family was structured through that clan. So you never marry somebody with the same clan, because that's your immediate kind of family.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd always marry somebody outside of that clan. So everyone was grouped by the clan, which followed their mother.
Mm-hmm.
So we still practice that today. But since the time of colonization, now we do have first names and last names. And it's usually where our names come from, like our English names. They were usually adopted by some kind of explorer or government superintendent. So one of them that I can think of that's most prominent is, like, you hear the last name Johnson in a lot of our communities,
mm-hmm.
but that comes from one of those superintendents that were working for the government at the time.
What is the seventh generation principle?
So the seventh generation principle comes from my people, the Haudenosaunee. And that comes from our great law of peace, which is our kind of our own constitution that we have. So that comes out of that in terms of the decisions that we make now has an impact 7 generations now. So what it prescribes us to do is that anything that we do now has to have a positive legacy for people who are going to eventually call this place their home. So the way the language translates those, like the faces that are still coming, that you see coming in the distance kind of thing. So if we think about it, it's about sustainability. So making sure that there's a future for people to thrive, but it's also about accountability. How are we accountable to people that we don't know who are going to be there, but how do we know what they need now, projected now 7 generations from now? So it's very daunting when you think about it, but I'm empowered by that, because what it tells you is that you're not just doing this for yourself, but you're doing it for people who have yet to come, who have yet to call Canada their home, who have yet to call Oakville or Mississauga or Brampton their home kind of thing. And if we think of it in a Sheridan kind of perspective, what we're doing here, what we have to do here, is think of those students that are probably in kindergarten right now. They're eventually going to be coming to Sheridan. What kind of education are they going to need? Because even in a 20-year span, the world we live in now is going to be different from now. And I think that's kind of how I think of it, is that you're looking beyond what's in front of you kind of thing. You're looking far in the distance of, okay, what am I doing now that's going to impact that? Am I doing anything that's going to harm it, or am I doing anything that's going to be accountable so that people can thrive when they come? So that's kind of that big principle that comes out of it, is that you should always be thinking future focused.
Thanks for listening to our interview with Elijah. You'll hear from Elijah again during our next episode, when he introduces Canada's complicated history and relationship with Indigenous peoples. Thank you for listening to Truth Be Told Podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Orr. Special thanks to Mel Bronwyn, assistant producer of Truth Be Told. This podcast is brought to you by Sheridan Life Radio.